This evening I want to show you a very broad overview of what happened to Christian people after the death of Jesus Christ. And that will cover a period of time up until about 1700s, which we will have already begun to colonize. England would have already begun her colonization of the New World. And so I want to give you an insight into one particular group of people known as the Waldenses, who are perhaps had the longest time of their existence as our ancestors as any other group. So this evening we'll talk about the Waldenses, where they were, what they believed, and what happened to them. And next Wednesday evening we'll look at the Albigenses, who were in southern France near the Pyrenees Mountains. You'll see in church history that God's people generally tried to find a place that was not inhabited and one that was very difficult for troops to come in any number. And this was their hiding places. And many of them lived there for hundreds of years. And some of them are still in the Waldensian valleys. And I'll tell you why they're not Baptist people anymore, which is a good lesson for us. And I appreciate our young people who are here. I hope that all of this will be meaningful to them. I'm sure it will be. And remind all of us that there was a lot of sacrifice so that we could have the truth more than simply the death of Christ. This is the stoning of Stephen. I believe that as I've studied church history, he is the first martyr. I do not look upon Jesus as a martyr in the sense of the usage of the word today, but Stephen gave himself as a martyr for the truth. But Jesus was a sacrifice as well as a martyr. So I look more upon him as a sacrifice because I think that gives him more honor and describes what he did for us and puts it in a better and more reverent situation. The word martyr is transliteration of a Greek word that means witness. So when we talk about martyrs, we're talking about people who were witnesses to the truth. As you recall from your Bible study, Stephen was stoned to death because the Jews believed that he was a blasphemer in preaching that Jesus was the Christ or the Anointed One. So the first persecution of Christian people, as far as losing their lives are concerned, was under the Jewish civil authorities, urged on by the Jewish religious authorities. And then the last one that we read about in the history of sacred history is John. John the Baptist, or John the Revelator, I should say, exiled on the Isle of Patmos, and that is one of the last records we have in the Bible of someone who was persecuted for the cause of Christ. But John was sent to the Isle of Patmos not by the Jewish people but by the Roman government because of his not having obeyed the laws concerning the state church, and therefore he was exiled rather than put to death. History, though we do not have the exact dates or everything that we probably would like to know about what happened to the apostles, we know that Paul was beheaded in Rome. We know that John was exiled to Patmos. And we have some indications that the rest of the apostles may have died as martyrs, but we do not have any sacred or secular proof of that fact. The Roman persecution of Christians is generally in this stylized version. You see it many, many times. You know, Christians nothing, Lions won, or however people talk about things occurring in a coliseum, or as a form of entertainment. In the arenas, this is where they entertain people on the weekend or on special holidays by pitting men against men or men against exotic animals that had been brought back from nations where they had conquered, and so they brought in hippopotami, they brought in lions, they brought in crocodiles and had big entertainment, and one of them, unfortunately, was that people were torn to death by lions and so many other ways of persecuting people that it's unbelievable. One of the strange things about early persecution, the early church, was that the young people were so involved in being willing to die for the cause of Christ. Now, probably the whole accusation was that you were worshiping another king. Now, yes, he's dead, but he has said he was coming back to life and rule as a king, so if you're worshiping him, you're worshiping a king, and that's a death penalty in the Roman Empire. But there were so many of these young people who were standing true to their faith that they finally would not let them make professions of faith or make them church members or immerse them until they were in their 20s. Because they were being arrested and put to death at early ages of 12 and 13 and 14. So they waited until they were well into their, well, almost middle age, which would have been 20 at this particular time. Again, you see the stylized version of what's happening. And this is going on until the union of church and state, which was about 328. And then the Christians the pagans did not persecute Christians, but now it changed to where Christians began to persecute Christians. So there were three persecutions, as I mentioned. First of all, the Jewish nation persecuted them as heretics or blasphemers. The pagans put them to death for being proselyters. The word proselyte means to change one's view. So they were changing the view of people's religion. Then after the Christian period began and there was a union of church and state, it was about year 460 that someone was imprisoned and then ultimately put to death because they would not have their children baptized as infants, or they would not take communion, or they would not confess their sins in the ear of a priest. Those were generally the three things that our people died for more than anything else. When you think about it, the Roman Catholic Church believes in the virgin birth. They believe in the inspiration of the Scriptures. They believe in so many things that we can say, yes, we believe in them too. But where our vast and unforgivable difference was, we would not have infants baptized, we would not take communion from the hand of the priest, and we would not offer ourselves for auricular confession, which means to confess your sins into another man's ear. These were the three main problems that the state church had with our people. One of the things that we do know for sure is that some people in fleeing from persecution, Mediterranean Sea over here, and they came around Italy, and there are a number of them stopped at the very boot heel of Italy, and they are really non-existent now, but a group came in to this area, evidently traveling either up the Po Valley, up past Rome, or just in little vessels sailing along the coast here until they got into this very small area here in the Alp Mountains. And the Alp Mountains are just a continuation of the Rocky Mountains on our earth, on the globe. So if you've ever been in the Rocky Mountains, you have some idea of what the Waldensian Mountains are like. This is the three valleys of the Waldensian Valleys. And one is the Angrogna Valley on your right, and the Middle Valley, and then a third valley. The valley that I visited and some of our people visited with me is the Angrogna Valley. And the word Angrogna means groan. So it's the Valley of Groans. This is the Piedmont area of the Alp Mountains. The word Piedmont means at the foot or the foot of the mountains. Anytime you see the word a Piedmont area, it always means a patio, a foot, so it's a foot of a mountain. These people came here converted by the apostles. So they're fleeing into these valleys around 100-120 A.D. So we know that these were people of antiquity. And they came here to make a home for themselves away from the world, if they could really have it that way. And it's a beautiful place. Here's what we'd call a homestead. It was very steep in a lot of places. They fixed little gardens, and they had cows and some sheep. Little streams flowing from the glaciers or melting snow all over the area. And this was a very difficult place for soldiers to come and stay in force. They had to come single file up these mountains, roads, or passages, so the people had time to flee and hide. And this is what they generally did. They did not stand and fight. They usually just took their children and what they could and went higher into the mountains, into a cave or some other place, and hid there until the soldiers left. Then they went back to their homes or their homesteads. These persecutions sometimes were 30 or 40 years apart, depending on who the Pope was, depending upon who the Bishop of Turin was. Turin was close, about 60 miles from these valleys that I'm talking about. And if the Bishop of Turin got aggravated because these people were witnessing to their people and were gaining influence and gaining in number, then they would contact the Pope and he would contact the civil authorities, and then they would begin a purge, if they could, of these people. They finally purged them out in 1686. 3 years later, they came back in 1689, and they've been there ever since. So they just lost 3 years of being excluded from the valleys from about 150 or so. Here's a typical family, and I got this out of a museum, some photographs and pictures from the person who was overseeing the museum. He was 80 years old, and he knew why we were there, was so happy that somebody realized what they had endured, and he gave me a lot of access to pictures and documents that I was very proud to get. But these people were not ignorant barbarians. Sometimes our people are portrayed that way. But our books have been burned. We have been an illegitimate group of people. And so we haven't had time to build universities. We haven't had time to build colleges until about the year 1700. And so we've had a very difficult time educating our children, but some way we've been able to do it. The women were extraordinary workers with needlework, all lace and things of this nature. Some of the lace and decoration in the finest castles in France and Italy were done by the Waldensian women. They were so good that they recognized who they were, and this was later. They did this. These are their homes because of the mountain fall. The people lived in the upper story, and in the wintertime, their animals were brought into the lower floor, and that helped to keep the house warm and also kept the animals from freezing. Their cupboards and houses that I saw were beautiful. These are all hand-carved and made in their cabinet shops or in their own little storage buildings next to them. Very industrious people. Here are some of the instruments that were collected in the museum that came from the ancient Waldenses, which is engineering tools, I believe. Is that right, Richard? And then here are medical supplies. These are the two things that they were outstanding in: engineering, building things, number two, and medical. And because they were considered the best physicians in Europe, they were often kidnapped and brought from the valleys into some influential person's house and kept there so that they could be their physician. The women oftentimes were taken and kept so that they could teach the queen's children or the wealthy people's children how to be industrious and how to be homemakers, how to organize things, how to sew and make things. So they were well respected in every way except their religion, and the religion condemned them many times to death. This is their architecture. The roof is slate, and all of this is put together without any cement of any kind, except they repaired it by putting some cement around where the door is there. So they were great builders with rock and the materials that were at hand. This is an outdoor oven. They'd build these, and several families in the little village would come here, and they would all bake their bread on the same day. And as I could determine, most of it was like our sourdough bread, real hard cover on the outside, and would last for a week or two. This, you can see, you did not need any equipment to farm. No tractors, combines, or anything, because it was so hilly. But they still were very industrious people. Where did they worship? We do not have an account of a house of worship that they built until 1556. Where did they meet for worship? They met in someone's house in the village, but generally in the summertime, they gathered under these overhanging rocks, what is termed the monitions. And here would be a typical congregation of people as they worshiped. They had a logo. This is the history of the Christians in the Valles Waldensian. So this is a better site. The statement on it is Lux Lucet in Tenebris, and that is the light shined in darkness. It had a candle and the stars, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, representing the seven churches of Asia as a representative of churches in all ages or in every age. So that's the oldest logo that we have. They wouldn't have worn a cross like we do today. In fact, when I first began preaching, you never saw Baptist people wearing crosses because it was an emblem that they had forbidden themselves to wear because they did not want to be identified by that cross as being a Catholic. So this was the logo that they used. Here's the college of the Barbs, the word Barbs meaning pastor. It was started in 1100, and their pastors came from these valleys here to attend what we would call seminary. They were people of the Bible. That's how they referred to themselves. This is the inside of the classroom, and this is sitting on the table, this solid pedestal of stones and one huge rock, and that was, they sat around it and they studied the Bible. And the Bible became so important to them and to their way of life in every respect that if they had a disagreement or an argument among themselves, they appealed to la tavola, that is, let's go to the table. And they would sit around the table and solve their quarrels and their misunderstandings, or even land situations or property or whether a person didn't pay his bill or not. They were governed, actually governed as a group of people, several congregations, by this philosophy. Those who were taught and trained in the seminary went out all over Europe, two by two, and they carried a just what they could carry on their backs. I would start to say a backpack, something similar to that. But instead of carrying items that were not very valuable, they carried jewelry and things that were valuable. And they went to different houses and made a stop of people that they perhaps had gotten acquainted with on other tours. And they would display their wares before them. And then if the person showed any interest in who are you and where are you at, they'd be very, very careful not to say any more than just what couldn't be construed as a criticism of the state church. And finally, one of them might say, well, you've seen the pearl necklaces, and they're very beautiful, but may we tell you of the pearl of great price? If the person answered affirmatively, then they told them about Jesus Christ. And then they made trips, like annually, around to all these families that had shown an interest or been converted, and that's how the gospel got spread into many places in Europe, in Germany, in Bohemia. These people became very strong as Christian people. So they were not simply in the valleys to survive. They extended themselves in what we would term missionary work. According to what I had read, their offerings were offered, was divided into thirds. They had a third for the pastor, a third for the poor, and a third for missions. That was just the technical or way they agreed to divide their offerings. This is Torre Pellice, which is the tower by the river. And you can see it's a very old town. I think it was founded somewhere in the 600s. I'm not sure. It's a very beautiful and wonderful place, and that's where they had after the Reformation period, they began to decide that they wanted to be like other groups, especially like the Presbyterians. So they began to get a headquarters place and a place from the museum, and it was located here at Torre Pellice. As I traveled one Saturday from Paris to Brussels, Belgium, we passed this place that was, in World War II, one of the concentration camps. And you can see three little towers right in the middle of the building, three little areas sticking up and some other buildings around it. And those towers are the smokestacks where they burned the bodies of the people that were poisoned by poison gas. in order to rid Europe of the Jews. Jewish people were considered the problem. They looked on Jewish people as being in control of universities. They looked at them, they control the financial system in that they, many of them own banks and they're the bankers, they're the physicians. And so they looked upon Jewish people who had migrated after Titus destroyed Jerusalem into other countries. And they were very jealous of them, very angry after a period of time because they seemed to be, for their population, far too important. So Hitler started the program or program to annihilate them, wipe them out. Well, we say that there were some 6 million Jews that were put to death or died on their way to and from concentration camps. When I thought of this, I thought also of this. Baptist people, our forefathers, they had their Holocaust from about 100 A.D., to about 1700, and really about 1650 before there was freedom of conscience or freedom of worship anywhere in the world. And this began in England in about 1648, 50, 51, where you didn't die for what you believed. You might be put in prison. You might be boycotted, you might not be able to work, a lot of real serious problems, but at least you didn't die. So we've had our Holocaust, and some have, by figuring back and looking and thinking, that the figure of 50 million people through the centuries died at the hands of state churches. So that's 44,000 more than the Holocaust. So it's 44 million more than the Holocaust. So we are a blood-bought people. As we sit here this evening, there's buckets of blood in our past. We're Christians because the Lord Jesus shed His blood. Stephen shed his blood. The apostles, Peter and others, were whipped and shed their blood. They died martyrs' deaths and shed their blood. And from then on, until there was really no absolute and total religious freedom in this world anywhere, until 1778 in the United States of America, when the first 10 amendments to the Constitution was adopted. That's when you could worship whatever and whomever, or not worship. Freedom of conscience and freedom and liberty was, and that's why we don't think that much about it. We think things have always been just like they are. And we think of other cult groups or somebody else in a foreign land, but we don't connect with them from the viewpoint of the religion. But this was the oven you saw back at another slide, and there were actually people placed in here and burned to death. And that's authenticated in a book that Samuel Morland wrote, and I'll give you a little more information about that a little bit later. This is looking up from the Casa del Tana, which is the Cave of the Bear. And I didn't bring the best slide I had, but this is looking up. This was a hiding place. And very late in the Waldensian history, in fact, the early 1600s, late 1500s, really severe persecution fell upon the Waldenses. They went to their ancient hiding places, and there were about 146 people here, older people, women and children, or women with infants, who could not go higher into the mountains. They just had to be hid because of infirmity or illness or because they had infants with them. So they hid them here. They were discovered, and leaves and debris was dropped through this opening down onto the bottom of the cave, and then a flame was dropped through this hole, and it caught the leaves and things on fire, and the smoke was terrible, and there were 140-something people that were put to death here. They hadn't harmed anyone. They were just Waldenses. And by the way, the word Waldense doesn't come from Peter Waldo, sort of a reformer early in the 12th century or the 13th century, but the word Waldensian means valley dweller. So their name actually states that they live in the valley, the valleys of the Piedmont. And this is another place where they hid. And in order to get into this area, they had a pulley and all arranged up at the top where they could let you down the side of this mountain and you swung in there and you were safe. So they had to devise many, many places of safety. I thought perhaps a half a dozen or so, but not long ago I read where there were actually hundreds of caves and places where 10 people could hide, or a family could hide, or 30 people could hide. Many of them were never discovered. That's how they survived. This is the Champharan, the meta of Champharan. You can see where it's it's just really a meta of grass. And we're making our way over to that. And in the Champharan Valley is a monument. And there are some people you might know around, gathered around it. And this was erected by the Waldensian people for this moment, to commemorate what happened here. Whenever Calvin and others found out that there were a group of people who had been persecuted for hundreds of years for what they believed, they immediately wanted to make contact with these people, because Geneva, Switzerland is just over the mountains from this, and you go through a tunnel at Mont Blanc, and they're real close, but they didn't have a tunnel back then, of course. But anyway, they sent representatives to the churches of the valleys of the Piedmont, and they said, "We want to make contact with you. Perhaps we can all work together." Well, the Waldenses were so downtrodden, so anxious to have peace, to have someone who would recognize them without calling them heretics, that they allowed representatives of John Calvin to come and pastor the churches while all of the Barbs, their pastors, went into Geneva and studied in a college there. And when they did, the Waldensian language, which was a Romance language, was corrupted, and they became French speakers because that's what their pastors at that time were preaching. So at this point, they gave up who they were and became what we refer to as Protestants. They changed their church style in the sense of being just themselves and doing things like we do for business, to having elders and presbyteries and things of that nature. So here's where they lost their identity as a church, as we would view a New Testament church. They never succumbed to physical punishment, the pain and suffering, all that they endured. But they did lose their identity when they joined with other groups. And you may wonder why. I don't want to join anything or anybody. We don't belong to the American Baptist Association. We affiliate with other churches that also are affiliated in a group called the American Baptist Association. We don't belong to it. We don't ask them what we can do. We do what we want to do as an independent sovereign, in the sense of no strings attached church. And that's why when I see just a hint of Well, let's join in together and worship with everybody in town on Thanksgiving. I just say no thank you. We know how to observe Thanksgiving, and we can do it well. And that is very unpopular in the age in which we live today. There are not a lot of people like us that's left. They do say, well, we can all get along. We can all worship together. But I don't think we can. You have to worship in spirit and truth, not just because you want to get along with people and be a good neighbor. That's a bad reason to do much of anything except have a 4th of July barbecue. The Servetus affair. Servetus was an Anabaptist. He had gone into Geneva where John Calvin was on the right, and he had begun to oppose infant baptism. And this angered Calvin so much that he took Servetus to court, and they decided that he was a heretic, and so they took him to Lake Geneva. And since he loved water so much, which that is immersion as the true form of baptism, they wrapped chains around him and dropped him off of this pier into Lake Geneva. That was the founder of the Presbyterian Church. So I know this, you say, oh, they wouldn't do that now. I don't know. I don't think they would. We live in America. We appreciate freedom. But their church doctrines haven't changed, nor have the Catholic doctrines changed. What has changed is that we all live under the Constitution of the United States. It's not that their doctrines have changed if they had an opportunity. You say, well, I don't think they would if they had an opportunity. I'm glad we have a Constitution standing between us and a dominant group of people. This is the church at Pra del Torno, near where the college for their pastors was. And this building was built in 1556. It is the first building that they ever had. It was built first. And they built it right on top of a little mountain, you might say. And the reason they did it is so they could see in every direction if there was anybody coming, like troops that were marching on them, and they could flee and get away from them. That's the pulpit that they had. And you think, my, that really is tall. And they had communion, one set. That's their communion set there out of pewter. But what they did is you went up about 3 or 4 steps. Wasn't it, Richard, that you went up into that? What they were elevating was not the preacher. They elevated the preaching of the Word. To them, that was the most important thing that occurred in their worship services. And there, I had a slide of the pews that they had, and there had dates carved in them, you know, and all, I knew they were Baptists right off. And I looked under the seat to see if there's any gum, and there wasn't, so I knew it wasn't, you know, modern Baptist, this old-fashioned Baptist that just took that four-hour sermon by whittling a little bit. This man, a likeness of him, is Oliver Cromwell. Oliver Cromwell aided in the overthrow of Charles I, and the kingdom was ended with the beheading of Charles I, and a commonwealth was instituted. And Lord, this Oliver Cromwell was made Lord Protector over the commonwealth. Well, he was an independent. That is, he was not an Anglican. He was not a Baptist, although there were a lot of Baptists around who joined his army because they were being persecuted terribly. This is 1646, I believe. Anyway, about that period of time. He heard Oliver Cromwell when he became Lord Protector, and he himself was an independent. a very godly man, but yet very severe also as a leader of the army. He sent Samuel Morland, who was a well-known inventor and a very popular person with the English. He sent him to the Waldensian Valleys to find out if these rumors were true that people had been put to death there who were not of the Catholic faith, who had been persecuted for centuries, because they really didn't have much information coming out that was accessible to them. So Samuel Morland went and he wrote his report. It really isn't a book, but it was a history of the churches of the valley, of the churches, of the history of the valley, of the churches of Piedmont Mountain. Anyway, he brought it back to Oliver Cromwell, and after some period of time, it was printed in this book. 1658 was the printing date of it. And here's the material that Morland brought back. It's a rather thick book, but it had a pictorial section. And each one of these, and there are probably 50 of them in all, I just chose some that are actually the less violent. He had an artist with him. He went to the registers of the little villages and towns. So these are not imaginary people. These people all had names, and they had what they had done wrong and the date of their execution. Now, women were not spared. They had some serious problems that I'll talk about next week, about people witnessing to all the people who came and stood around. And some of their witnesses were unbelievable because they witnessed that they felt no pain, that they were dying and going to a better place. And this was very effective, and people who came to just view it as a form of entertainment went away seriously thinking about what they'd heard. There was two ways of burning people at the stake. You could put a lot of very flammable material around them and light it, and it just swept up in the smoke, and in very few minutes they died. Or you could build it out of solid wood, like stove wood or whatever, and just build it around the bottom of it so that after a while it began to get so hot that it began to burn the people's feet off, burn their legs off, but it seared the vessels and veins as it did it, so they would just actually die in excruciating pain. That was the most painful way to put people to death. Here you see that people were pulled apart by donkeys. You can see a child that's being dashed against the rocks. That was always an issue, to pick the infants up and just dash them against the rocks and slay them in that fashion. Here they pull a child apart. Now, this is not imagination. These things actually happened. Throwing people over a bluff. Here they're burying someone alive. It's torture. Now these, I've wondered about this for a long time, but these were smelting pots for iron or silver, so they really did have these furnaces built where they could have these extremely hot fires. But this woman is praying as she's been lifted up into these. This is their hero, Henry Arnaud. He is the general, colonel, I raised him a rank for you. He was the colonel who was taken in. The reason that the Waldensians left is that they finally made a truce with them, and they said, if all of you people will come into Turin and give yourselves up, we will enumerate you, find out where your land is, and we'll make all of this, and then you can go back. So they set the month of October for all these people to show up, about 12,000. They put them in a concentration camp outside of Turin, and they left them. And with the promise, just any day now, we're going to let you loose, and you can cross the mountains into Geneva. Well, they kept them there, and they kept them there, and they kept them there until just before Christmas. And many of the people died out of exposure, disease. But they said, okay, you can go to Geneva. Geneva said, we will accept them as people who are fleeing tyranny. And going over the mountains in the winter, only 3,000 of them ever got to Geneva. While they were in Geneva, they decided pacifism hasn't worked for us, and we're not going to practice it anymore. We're going to fight. So they were armed by William of Orange, and they were trained, and they were furnished rifles. And an army of 800 Waldensian men came back over the mountains in the dead of winter, surprised the troops that were in little villages of maybe 100 here, 50 here, whatever. And they set the tone for the battles that are fought in what we call guerrilla warfare. They didn't, if they lined up to fight in the traditional way, the Waldenses just sort of went off into the woods and hid. But when they started marching somewhere, they were there with rocks to drop down on them or get them in a narrow valley, and with their swords and rifles, killed many of them. And their fighting back really frightened these people. They couldn't figure it out because they had not had any serious problems with them except just to run them into the hills. But they fought back, and they recaptured or retook their land 3 years later in 1689. And they had been there ever since. But this was the man who trained and led them, and he's the most honored figure in their history. This is their emblem, and this is in a big concave area, well lighted. But in life came from death, okay? That's the root system in this rock here, that out of all the hardships of life, there sprang a tree that symbolized the Waldensian people. Okay. That's all that I know that's enough. But you just get a glimpse of what these people went through all the time preserving what we believe. There is a document that's still in print that was published in 1120. That is what we would call a doctrinal statement. And it's surprising how solid that doctrinal statement is. I've read it many times, and there's some of the language that doesn't fit us today, but generally speaking, what they believed, they're not going to take communion from a priest. They're not going to confess their sins to a man. They're not going to baptize anyone except believers, and they're baptized by immersion. These are key doctrines that we believe.